16, right?
Yes.
Yep.
All right. Well, I forgot to introduce myself yesterday for the recording, so I'll do that now. I'm Anna Marie Vegan, and I teach ethics at Loyola University in Chicago, both grads and undergrads, a lot of pre-med students and nursing students, but also theology majors. And it is such a delight to be here with an incredible abundance of riches in terms of what you all bring. And so we're going to definitely hear from me today, but I also really want to emphasize some discussion about some of these issues related to life and death. Our central question that I want us to keep in mind and complexify and wrestle with is, what does it really mean to respect life? What is involved in that in terms of policies, medical practices, how we tend to life at both its beginning and end? That's where we're going to focus today. It's a very much of a touted political statement, but could we offer up a thick description of what we're really talking about? So I think there are some pieces to respecting life and human dignity that we should look at today and discuss together. Racial, socioeconomic, political dimensions to respecting life. A lot of times when you hear people say, I respect life, or everybody should respect life, they're not thinking about the social structures and economic structures needed to really make life flourish. They say sometimes, well, you have a duty to have that child. But what they don't think about is, well, what about good educational programs, Head Start, employment opportunities, all the kinds of pieces of a social fabric that really make sure that life flourishes once it is born. It just stops at make sure that child is born kind of thing. And I think we need a wider scope of attention to think about respecting life. I also think in our society, this is really for the United States, we have to think about the limits as well as the purposes of human autonomy and individual rights. And here is where you might hear me critiquing some elements of pro-choice movements, because I don't know if that's a sufficient lens to get at all of the big moral questions related to life and death. It's an individual choice. I understand why that is important and where that comes from. And related to life and death, you hear a lot of people wanting to choose, make sure they're in control of their death. And you want to hear, a lot of times I hear control about when and how they conceive and such. And I understand that's valid, but are there any limits to that, to human control and autonomy? Then I want to ask these two interrelated questions. What does it mean to live well and to die well? And how can we live well with a view toward dying well, instead of seeing them as opposites, but kind of on a continuum? So those are the kinds of things that I hope that we get at in our work together today for an hour. And I'm going to give you a couple of case studies, and I've got a little clip from a film that I think will be thought-provoking for our discussion. But before we go into that, and I want to remind you, in case you haven't picked up a handout on resources for further dialogue, one of my real hopes is that anything that I have said that has been helpful, engaging, produced some thought and reflection, that you might take it back to your homes and communities and have a discussion with neighbors or have a discussion with your congregation or colleagues, however you want to do it, so that we can keep the discussion going. Because this is a big year for healthcare. A lot is possible. And I think the more we get people talking, not to give any one right answer, but just have the dialogue be robust and widespread, I think the better the outcome will be. So, there are some handouts that you can peruse, and this is the one to pick up. And the books there are all really good, and I suggest that you take a look at them and think about them for your own reading and library. So, first of all, before we talk about current issues in life and death, I want to just, because I do think it's so important that white people think a lot about whiteness and racial privilege, I want to do just a very brief discussion of racial and socioeconomic dynamics in our history as they relate to medical research. Chris, can I borrow your watch so that I have to
come on?
Does anybody, does everyone know, or does the name Tuskegee ring some bells? Here. Would anybody, and please don't feel embarrassed at all, because I don't assume that, I mean, I don't know a million things. So would anybody like me to go over a couple brief things about it, just to remind you, refresh you?
Yes.
Okay, great. The Tuskegee Syphilis Study. That took place for 40 years in the United States, from 1932 until 1972. The dates are important. What happened is that the United States government, or a group of researchers within the United States government, in the form of the U.S. Public Health Service, that was the precursor to the Department of Health and Human Services. So the Public Health Service decided to do a study. They wanted to, the purpose of the study was to study the natural progression of syphilis, meaning what happens to the human body when syphilis is present and it's not treated. And at the time of 1932, there weren't many treatments. We didn't have penicillin yet. So the researchers decided to go to an area of the country, to Macon County, Alabama, where there was a high percentage of syphilis infections. And it was also to an area of predominantly black sharecroppers who had never been to any kind of doctor in terms of, other than say perhaps a traditional healer in their own community, but had never been into a, what we would say, you know, a nurses and doctors kind of clinic or office. So the researchers went there and they worked with African American folks, nurses and professors and people at the Tuskegee Institute, which was founded by Booker T. Washington and had a good reputation. And together with those collaborators, they recruited about 400 poor men, sharecroppers, to be a part of the study. And what the men received for their participation was free medical visits. And I say visits because they didn't receive anything therapeutic other than a bit of aspirin now and again. And they would get chest x-rays, and people would listen to their hearts and lungs. You know, they'd get a physical exam, but they weren't going home with a lot of medication. And they would get a free lunch. They would get transportation there. And for a lot of these men who lived in remote areas, transportation was a big deal because then they could socialize with people, they could get some shopping done. It was a lot easier for them. So that was a big incentive. And they would get, when they were promised burial funds for whenever they died. Now the men were told, not that they had syphilis, but that they had bad blood. Bad blood was a euphemism for any number of conditions. It did not have any stigma attached to it, and it certainly wasn't connected with any sexual contact. The men were never told that they had syphilis until the news story broke in 72. And they were not told that this bad blood, they could possibly pass it on to their spouses or children. So the men were monitored. They came in to see how the natural progression of the disease happened. And the other thing about it is that when penicillin did become available in 1947, the men were specifically kept from getting it. Even the men that were in the U.S. Armed Services, and all the armed servicemen were getting penicillin if they showed syphilis. These men, they had tracked them and had separated them out and told the U.S. Army and other military branches, not these guys, because we're doing a study. So in 1972, the news story broke, and the study was abruptly halted. Had the study continued, it could have been going on into the late 90s, because the end point of the study was set to be when the last person dies. Because the reason why the men got the autopsy, got the burial insurance, is because they also had to sign a form agreeing to have their body have an autopsy done on it, so they could see the final effects of the syphilis. So even though in 1947 we have a very good treatment for syphilis, these men are kept from it. And they then, by 1972, countless men had died, and of course wives and children had also been infected. Now the other thing that's really important, and why I say the dates are so important, is because what happened 1946, 1947, after World War II.
Lots of babies.
Related to medical research, sorry. Oh. Nuremberg. The United States was very much involved in holding the Nazis accountable for the unethical medical research practices that it had done on Jews and others. We were horrified by what educated MDs and PhDs did in the name of science. Somehow, that didn't ring any bells here at home. Because the study continued into the 70s. And the researchers themselves didn't translate informed consent issues in Nazi Germany to here. How had these men had, they had no informed consent. They didn't know they had syphilis, they didn't know that they weren't getting therapeutic treatment, that they were only being studied and watched. The other issue about that is that in terms of Nazi Germany, the United States, do you know that in the early 30s and 20s we had sterilization laws on the books that were eugenically based? And that the Nazis modeled their sterilization laws on us? And that the eugenic scientists who had formed that legislation in the United States were quite proud that the Germans had taken that model? So we can't simply look at the horrors of eugenics and focus at all on Nazi Germany. We have some of our own history that we have to wrestle with. But the thing about experimentation on African Americans in particular is that Tuskegee was neither the beginning nor the end. Slaves were experimented upon without their consent. Their bodies, after they died, were robbed, so that because there was a real taboo around getting bodies for skeletons and doing autopsies, and so the easiest bodies to get were those of slaves, because who was going to care? Who was going to get upset? The guy who founded gynecology, and his name is Sonia. Do you have it on the tip of your tongue? I have it written down. Okay. Well, he's oftentimes, according to Vanessa Gamble, a father of gynecology, and his name is Sims. Marion Sims. He used three Alabama slave women to develop an operation to repair fistulas. And he operated on them without anesthetic, and then once he perfected his technique, he did use white women volunteers, but by then he also used anesthetic. So there's a lot of history. Another study was done by a man who used the slave men to study the effects of the sun and heat on slaves and how you could make it so that they could withstand the sun and heat longer, to work longer. So they would subject them to extreme heat. He put them in a pit and watched them basically bake in the sun, and then would revive them after he fainted and tried different techniques for that. So there's a long history. And the question is, what sometimes people say, why are there still issues of trust with doctors? I mean, Tuskegee, it was awful, it was terrible, but it did end in 1972. So shouldn't people have more trust? This is not 1972 anymore. Could those kinds of things happen today where people's informed consent is violated in medical research? I think there are at least reasons for concern, although I do think researchers have a lot of important and wonderful and noble goals. And the example that I want to give you today is around you in the US with foster children who are HIV positive. In the late 90s and early 2000s, there was a lot of research going on with HIV-positive foster kids. And in New York City, 465 children were tested and were found to be HIV-positive and were in a part of this clinical trial to test new HIV drugs for pediatrics. Good, noble, important goal. As you can imagine, a lot of parents who have children aren't too excited about having their children be a part of research unless it's really to save their life and there aren't a lot of good alternatives. Well, in the case of these foster kids, their parent or legal guardian was the city agency in New York City, the same city agency that made the deal with the researchers and the drug companies who donated the drugs for the study. So what happened is that these kids were given these drugs, and in some cases they had very severe side effects, losing weight, nausea. Some of the kids started to refuse taking the medications orally, and then they would have stomach tubes inserted and such. And in two cases that I've read about, foster parents, they were in individual foster homes, stopped giving them the drugs because they felt the side effects were too severe. And in those two cases, city agencies came and removed the children and put them in group homes so that the research could continue. Now, I know that we need new AIDS drugs. And I know that it's hard to see any child put through difficulty, and that I'm not saying that we shouldn't do this kind of research, but I am saying these kids who are 99% black and or Latino had no independent advocate.
And isn't that often the case in the attempt to do a double-blind study on most medications or treatments, that you know, there's always that ethical question between, is it legitimate, are the findings legitimate if it's not double-blind, and then, you know, finding people that you're willing to either give the placebo to, give the placebo or deny treatment or whatever.
Yeah. And I don't know how that worked, because I believe that these, maybe there were some of the kids who were getting placebos or were getting the traditional drugs, that must have been, and then other kids that were getting the tested drugs. So, yeah, when your life's on the line, do you want to take the chance of getting the placebo? But the difference in this case is that if it were my son and I'm the parent, then I could say at any time, we're pulling this child out of this study.
Can a municipality be a guardian or a group of children?
They are.
It's like two.
They are. But can they then make those kinds of decisions in that same sense? It's complicated. Now, I'm going to stop here on this kind of information, but I want to encourage you to read this book called Medical Apartheid. It's in the bookstore. It's by Harriet Washington, that documents the experimentation of African Americans and Africans from colonial times to the present day.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say it strikes so true to me that it also now goes the other direction, because this is so embedded in our healthcare system, that as a healthcare provider working with the public clinic, when there are trials and other opportunities to offer people, and most of my clients, almost all of them, are not white.
Yeah.
And I am a white person. It's hard. You can't take that factor out of the conversation. And you know, even if you name it, you can't take it away. It's still there.
Trust is huge.
Yep.
What are you doing to me? Other examples are men in prison have been experimented upon. Now, they're offered a little money or incentives, but can someone who is not a free person give full informed consent? Another example is the Mississippi appendectomies. African American women, this is now post, this is Reconstruction, this is pre-civil rights and such, 40s, 50s, 30s and such, or went in for maybe to have a fibroid tumor removed or something like that. When they're under anesthetic, the doctor just made the decision that they should have a hysterectomy because they don't need to have any more kids. So there were uninformed, unvolunteered hysterectomies. So that book, Medical Apartheid, covers all of that. The legacy of that, as Sonia, you just so well said, lives and breathes in the present. It's not just back there for people. So when you're a healthcare provider or a genetic counselor, and you're trying to talk to folks and invite them to be a part of research or try to win their trust and say, you know, you're really here for them and you want to advocate for them, there are extra hurdles and obstacles to achieving that kind of provider-patient relationship that you would like, that we have to be aware of, I think. So that's all I wanted to say about context in terms of race in our country. Now I'd like to focus more on babies. You've seen mine, Benjamin, maybe, 16 months old. And I wanted to say at the outset, before I go any further into content, is that my partner Allison and I had this child. And while I have some concerns that you're going to hear about related to artificial reproductive technologies, he was conceived through the use of donor sperm. So there you have it. I have bought sperm. The full disclosure, which I don't give my students, but you guys are special. So. All right, now here's the thing about artificial reproductive technologies. ARTs. They are expensive, and they are not often, or not always, I shouldn't say often, but not always covered by private health insurance programs. Mine didn't cover really very much because, not so much of the cost factor, but because I work for a Catholic university. And I don't know, please, if you know of this and I'm wrong, tell me, I don't know of any state Medicaid program that covers any form of in vitro fertilization, eggs, sperm. Does anybody else know anything about
it? They barely cover.
So who can afford this are people with some degree of means, depending on how much you use. If you buy a couple vials of sperm, maybe it's not so expensive, but if you need to have embryos fertilized, you know, or created outside of the womb, or you need to buy both sperm and eggs, or you need to rent the womb of another person, a surrogate, the costs get pretty high, or you need multiple rounds. So what I'm thinking about is that, to a degree, especially when you think on a global scale, it's the affluent, a very small percentage of the world's population who can afford these technologies. And in contrast, many times it's impoverished women of color who are the surrogates, or it's the, who's the, who are the egg donors? College students who really need money, and who are smart, and who are have good features. So a college student can make anywhere, and this is documented in this book, The Baby Business, she is by Deborah Spar, who is a professor of business administration at Harvard. The going price for eggs from an egg donor is anywhere between $2,500 and $50,000. Wow. And that's in here, so what?
Yeah. Well, just when my sister graduated from Harvard Med School in the program, yeah. I can't tell you how many personal ads there were.
Oh, yeah.
For egg and sperm donors.
Oh, at Columbia University when I was in grad school, yeah. All over the place. Yeah.
No, but in the program. Like, so when you were sitting there, they were trying to get that population that was at Harvard's medical school
graduation. Because you guys
graduation.
Are so smart. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that they wanted those. Yeah.
And if you go to the bank websites, some of them really, I mean, there is one in Minnesota that I just found out about that specifically deals in Norwegian sperm. I kid you not. I kid you not. Smart Norwegian sperm. Well, we can only hope they're Lutherans. This industry of artificial reproductive technologies, as of 2004, is almost a $3 billion a year industry. Average costs for IVF range from $25,000 to $100,000. Surrogacy costs, what you pay both the woman who is the surrogate as well as the broker. There's always a broker agency that, almost always, that puts these things together. And that can range between $15,000 and $45,000. Sperm costs, well, if you get a deal, to maybe $250 a vial, up to $600, $700 and more per vial. Eggs, as I said, anywhere between $2,500 and $50,000. And another kind of cost that we don't always think about, adoption is not a bargain either. Adoption costs range in the area of $12,000 to $30,000 for a child. Now, what Deborah Spar is arguing is that all of this means that we are dealing in a commerce of children. Even adoption, even if the birth mother is not receiving money directly, that money is exchanging hands here. That's a market. There are products that are being sold and services. So questions of commercialization and commodification and the lack of regulation, I think, loom quite large, especially when we think about the fact that not everybody can buy in, other than they can sell you eggs if they're smart enough, or they can rent their room. Woo. The room woo.
And now people, Americans are going to, there's a show in India, Lucy Wu,
Who went to India? Lucy who?
Made all the difference in the world in the Indian woman's life.
Yeah, right.
This lifestyle for very little.
Exactly. And that's exactly my next example. Well, thank you very much. From March, no, you're not. You're just creating this incredible transition. So March of 2008, the New York Times reports, India nurtures the business of surrogate motherhood, where it is legal to, in not all European countries, it is legal to have these kinds of laws. So here, let me just read you a few paragraphs from this. It's called, this industry is now called reproductive outsourcing. And clinics in India provide surrogate mothers for foreigners. And they have been recently inundated with requests from the US and Europe because the news is getting out that India has skilled medical providers, relatively liberal laws, and low prices. Commercial surrogacy, which is banned in some states and in some European countries, was legalized in India in 2002. The costs come to about $25,000, roughly a third of the price in the United States, according to this article. Now that includes the medical procedures, payments to the surrogate mother, which is often but not always done through a clinic, air tickets, hotels for two trips to India. Why two trips? One for fertilization and the second to collect the baby. The donor and the surrogate are always different women. Doctors say that surrogates are less likely to bond with the babies if there's no genetic connection. If you want to Google how this works, Google Planet Hospital. That's one of these medical tourism agencies. You can also Google the term medical tourism. It's an increasing business for them. And here's the argument that's made. Is this exploitation or, on the other side, helping these women who would never be able to make this kind of money in other ways? So here we're going to hear both sides of that argument. In a country crippled by abject poverty, It is asked, how will the government body guarantee that women will not agree to surrogacy just to be able to eat 2 square meals a day? Even some of those involved in the business of organizing surrogates want greater regulation. They want to ensure that the surrogate gets a fair amount of money for being part of the process, and that they're concerned that if the business expands, that there are going to be industries and businesses and persons without the best motives who get involved. Currently, people who want to contract with the surrogate are paying $25,000 to $30,000, and the surrogate gets about $7,500 of that amount. And what one doctor in India says, surrogates do it to give their children a better education, to buy a home, or to start up a small business. This is as much money as they could earn in maybe 3 years. I don't think that this is exploiting the women. I feel that it is two people who are helping out each other. But it is very clear that an exchange between the rich and the poor is underway. The thumbprint, for example, of many illiterate surrogates is what stands out on the clients for client signatures. So they're not reading these forms. The surrogate mother does not know that she's working for foreigners, and she doesn't, and she also doesn't know if she's working for gay couples, because gay sex is illegal in India. And in one this case, a gay Israeli couple is the case study that's mentioned in this article. The interviewers here from the New York Times couldn't talk to any of the current surrogates, but it did track down one woman who had been a surrogate and is planning to become one again. And she explained to the journalist that she's separated from her husband, and she found that her monthly wages of 2,800 rupees, or about $69, as a midwife, were not enough to raise her 9-year-old son. So with the money she earned from the first surrogacy, more than $13,600, she bought a house. She expects to pay for her son's education with what she earns for the second, which is about $8,600, because the fees vary. She said, I have to save this money for my child's future. But what, because India is a socially conservative country, these women, they tell maybe their immediate families or the family members they trust, but then they kind of go to the clinic where they're housed and fed and make up excuses about why they're not around the other neighbors and relatives and such, because it would be a big stigma. This one man from Israel said that they perused the profiles of egg donors that were sent by email, and then they picked the one with the highest level of education. They rejected a factory worker in favor of a housewife because they thought that would be a less stressful lifestyle. And then they will get ultrasound images of their developing child by email. So, anyone want to discuss that? Is it exploitation? Is it giving women in India a chance, as well as couples who really want a baby that is a genetically, somehow connected to them genetically? You know, that possibility? How do you feel about this kind of a story? What are your comments or reactions?
It seems that women have always sold their bodies.
Well, certain women, certain classes of women.
Well, yeah. Women have had to sell themselves for one reason or another, which you mean, to make money.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that this is any worse than that, or better, or?
Difficult, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult.
Yes, sir.
It's just one of those things. That
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think the fact that they don't tell these women whose child they're bearing, that's kind of a red flag right there. I mean,
yeah.
Just maybe that's not a major thing, but it's certainly a factor.
Yeah, it's, you know, you think about, we picked a donor with identity release at age 18 because I really want Benjamin to know all the parts from which he comes. I mean, I don't want to feel like that's hidden information. And these children won't ever know exactly their egg side of things or the who carried them, nurtured them. But on the other hand, I think we can't apologize. I mean, if you, in a sense, if you really want a child and this is the only way to bring this child into being, then you are still giving that child life. But then here's the thing. Here's the deeper question. Do you think that there is an overemphasis, at least in U.S. society, on the biological definition of family?
Yes.
Why does it have to be? And I'm saying this as someone in Pottsburg, remember, so, but why does it have to be that this child has to have a biological connection to me to be my child? Now, it's not that adoption is this easy route or is really inexpensive, but there are a lot of people who have strong aversions to raising a child that is not their quote-unquote home. Or the extended family doesn't look at the child the same way and they worry about that and stigma. Do any of you know people that have had difficulty because of friends and family not fully getting it, why they want to adopt?
My grandmother, who's 103, when she was a child, when she was 8 years old, they lived in Kansas, and the orphan train came through. They'd bring orphans from the city on trains out west and stop at all the small farming communities and have like potluck dinner, and the children would stay in people's homes and people would decide to adopt them.
Yeah.
And my grandmother, remember, she was an only child, and they had this little girl that stayed with them, and she so wanted her to be her sister. Mm-hmm. And her father said, blood is thicker than water. Mm-hmm. I mean, she remembers that statement, blood mm-hmm. is thicker than water, and
yeah.
said, no, we won't adopt somebody who's not of our blood.
Good friends of mine adopted two children from Colombia, and a friend of theirs, her mother couldn't, so it not a their friend's mother, mm-hmm. who was in their close, all extended friends and such, when she met the kids, she commented in this hushed breath, oh, but they're so dark.
They're so dark?
They're so dark. I didn't know they're from Colombia. I thought they'd be not that dark. I mean, it was really a thing for them.
Yeah. My father's parents now passed away, but they were older, and my sister married an East Indian man, so that she has their biological children.
Uh-huh.
She looks like me, and the children look very East Indian.
And then they assume.
Well, yeah. They look very East Indian, the two kids, and, yeah. and my grandma said, they're not from our tribe. And they didn't live long. I mean, after they were all very old, elderly.
But
so
still,
it would have been interesting to watch how that developed.
I wonder if it's maybe getting better. I have my brother has two sons, one biological and one adopted, mm-hmm. and I remember my brother and his wife being extremely bothered mm-hmm. when anybody would say, or even my dad would say this for a while, but my dad quit that, mm-hmm. you know, these two grandchildren, one's adopted,
mm-hmm.
or Mike isn't this, or mm-hmm. Matt is this. And my brother and his wife were just so insistent on that these are their two sons, and people should not mm-hmm. differentiate. Now, they're both white.
Yeah, right.
But I wonder if that this blood is thicker than water business maybe is dying out a little bit?
Oh, I think some things are definitely changing. I mean, I have several friends who've adopted interracially, cross-racially and such, and their families are amazing and such. So, but I do think it's interesting that people will spend up to $100,000 or more, you know, they'll keep doing the IVF cycles. I mean, there are some people who are really, this is the way I'm going to have a kid, and if I don't have that, I'm going to be barren. And I'm going to have to deal with that and grieve. I mean, I've seen interviews with women who have fertility issues, and for them, they get really defensive and angry when you mention adoption.
Yeah.
Because, and I think every woman who... So that raises another question. Do we have an inherent right as human beings to procreate? Is it our natural right to have biological children? Or is it a gift? And we hope we are given this gift. And if we don't, and if we're not given that gift, then can we support one another to think about other ways of generativity? How can we generate life in a lot of different ways?
I think you hit the nail on the head, both at the beginning of life and the end of life, is this fear of grieving.
Yeah.
And
we're not very good at that.
The fear, the
yeah.
grief
yeah.
of aversion.
Yeah.
And then, you know.
Or what are the possibilities within the limits? Okay, so I'm not going to live forever. So then what am I going to do with my life? I'm not going to be a biological parent, or it's really hard to be one, so then are there other possibilities to give life? And to try to, out of the grief and within the limits, to find creative life-giving possibilities and hope, I think is really important. The next topic, though, gets into genetics, and I want to allow enough time for it. So, in addition to all of the artificial reproductive technologies that are available, a lot of prospective parents or pregnant couples are doing increasingly genetic testing on their embryos. Now, for cystic fibrosis, for Tay-Sachs, for Down syndrome, it's a range. For Huntington's, there are people, if they are having fertility problems, oftentimes for about $9,000, depending on insurance coverage and such, you can tack off a full range of screens called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, PIGD, and I have a genetic counselor here who can make sure I get this right if I say anything wrong. Linda, make sure you don't know. Okay. And what that will tell you is everything from gender to likelihoods of certain things they can tell you within like 95%, and other things are 80%, 70%, it's a range. But I think there's a big difference between saying, okay, my fetus has a certain chance for Huntington's disease or Alzheimer's at a later stage than Tay-Sachs, which they're not going to make it for very long outside the womb. You know, there are a lot of gray areas and gradations. In other words, the question that I think we have to wrestle with is, what is the difference between a defect and simply being different? Is having androgynous sexual organs a defect, or is it just, wow, that's really interesting, and that person could live a great and productive life if we don't do sexual reassignment surgery too soon before we know how that person identifies, or at all, if that person doesn't want it. Down syndrome. Those of you who know people with Down's kids, huge range. Some are incredibly high functioning, and others, you know, it's a lot more difficult. But, and the test is not going to tell you how high or low functioning that child will be. That's something you have to think about.
When I was doing social work, I worked specifically with kids with developmental disabilities, and apparently there was a waiting list to adopt, at that point in time, this was in the early 90s, to adopt kids with Down syndrome.
Yeah. I don't think that's so true now, but if people know about this, I think that genetic counselors play an important role, because not only do they give you this information, but if they're doing their job well, they give you the resources and the options. So then you do meet other families with Down kids and the social services organizations that are there. But here's the deal. In our society, where healthcare is such a huge issue of debate and the costs are so increasing, the more that we can test and know, this is what I think about could happen in increasingly in 10 or 15 years. Could it become, could the social mindset be, we now have the technology to have avoided these very high-costing pregnancies and births and children. You as an individual make a decision to have that child anyway, so it's up to you as an individual. Why should I, with my tax dollars, pay for care for these people when they could have prevented? Again, what are the limits of individual rights and then the social structures? If we look at it as an individual choice to have this testing, to have this child, then is society going to pull back and say, well, that's your choice, but leave me out of it. I want my money to go for other stuff. So I think that's really, and then to the difference between a defect and the difference, obviously we're not now testing embryos for how smart they're going to be, or if they're going to become musician aficionados, or if they're going to be gay. I mean, those kinds of things aren't out there, or eye color. But I do know that right now in this country and in other countries, abortions happen based on sex information. They don't tell the providers that's why they want to know the sex, but once they find out early enough, they do abort the fetus because, well, we wanted a boy first, we had three boys and we wanted a girl, or because they come from a culture where girls are not valued as highly and such. And you don't need actually genetic screening for that, all you need is an ultrasound, a high-level resolution ultrasound. Although that would be later in the pregnancy then. So that does happen, not only in India or China, but that happens in the United States. So let's take a look at this provocative clip from the film Gattaca to talk about genetics and eugenics, and is this our future? It's a drama. It's a little over the top, but I hope it's thought provoking. The story, the backstory, while we're getting this set up, is that a man played by Ethan Hawke, in the film is masking as someone he's not truly. In other words, every day he shaves his body and clips his hair so that he doesn't shed genetic traces. He attaches someone else's urine to his leg. He puts on a false piece of skin with blood underneath it so that he passes a blood test to prove his identity as this other person. Also that he can be an astronaut. So he is a genetic imposter in the film, afraid of being found out. And this is him explaining how he was born. He's talking about his life and the fact that when he refers to himself as this one man, he's not that man. But
the most unremarkable of events. Jerome Morrow, Navigator First Class, is about to embark on a one-year manned mission to Titan, 14th moon of Saturn. A highly prestigious assignment, although for Jerome, selection was virtually guaranteed at Earth. He's blessed with all the gifts required for such an undertaking, a genetic quotient second to none. No, there is truly nothing remarkable about the progress of Jerome Morrow, except that I am not Jerome Morrow. I was conceived in the Riviera, not the French Riviera, the Detroit variety. They used to say that a child conceived in love has a greater chance of happiness. They don't say that anymore. I'll never understand what possessed my mother to put her faith in God's hands rather than those of her local geneticist. 10 fingers, 10 toes, that's all that used to matter. Not now. Now, only seconds old, the exact time and cause of my death was already known.
Neurological condition, 60% probability. Manic depression, 42% probability. Attention deficit disorder, 89% probability. Heart disorder, 99% probability. Early fatal potential. Life expectancy, 30.2 years.
30
years.
The name for the certificate? Anton?
No, Vincent Anton.
From an early age, I came to think of myself as others thought of me, chronically ill. Every skinned knee and runny nose was treated as if it were life-threatening.
I'm sorry, the insurance won't cover it. If he fell...
But I was told that everything was...
I really wish there was something I could do.
Like most other parents of their day, they were determined that their next child would be brought into the world in what has become the natural way.
Your extracted eggs, Marie, have been fertilized with Antonio sperm. After screening, we are left, as you see, with 2 healthy boys and 2 very healthy girls. Naturally, no critical predispositions to any major inheritable diseases. All that remains is to select the most compatible candidate. First, we may as well decide on gender. Have you given it any thought?
We would want Vincent to have a brother, you know, to play with.
Of course you would. Hello, Vincent. You have specified hazel eyes, dark hair, and fair skin. I've taken the liberty of eradicating any potentially prejudicial conditions, premature baldness, myopia, alcoholism, and addictive susceptibility, propensity for violence, obesity, etc.
We didn't want, diseases, yes, but...
Right, we were just wondering if it's good to just leave a few things to chance.
You want to give your child the best possible start. Believe me, we have enough imperfection built in already. Your child isn't needing additional burdens. And keep in mind, this child is still you, simply the best of you. You could conceive naturally 1,000 times and never get such a result.
That's how my brother, Anton, came into the world. A son my father considered worthy of his name. By the time we were playing at Blood Brothers, I understood that there was something very different flowing through my veins. And I'd need an awful lot more than a drop if I was going to get anywhere.
You can see what happens to his life if you rent the film sometime. So, obviously that is a sci-fi flick and it's futuristic, but that sentence, remember, this child is the best, is still you, just the best of you. That to me doesn't sound so improbable that we would hear that in our own voices and hearts, or in that of healthcare providers talking with us sometimes. Reactions, comments to that clip? Objections?
It's hard to imagine that we would come to that. But you're right, we could.
Well, I mean, for example, right now, I think a very good and understandable thing that's being done is that when people are having artificial reproductive technologies and they have and they're using in vitro fertilization, most of the time, 3 to 6 eggs are fertilized. And right now, that decision about which ones to implant is made. And they make that decision based on taking a very small, obviously, genetic sample from each. And they know, for example, if you have a family history of breast cancer or colon cancer, and those genetic traits come up in some of the embryos, they will be deselected.
Huntington. That's the term they use, deselected.
Yeah. Huntington's is another one. And a good friend of mine, you know, this happens once you are out of the womb too. She is in her 40s. Her father died of Huntington's. Her sister has it. She has a 50% chance. I mean, no. Yes, of having it. And if she has the genetic character trait, it's 100% accurate. It's not just, well, you might get it. It's, no, you have it. You will. And your mid to late 40s is when it starts showing up. And she's really, really wondering, should she have this test or not? Now, let's backtrack that. She's an amazing person. And she has a lot of gifts, and she's a funny person. And I think, now, even if she does have that trait, would it be better, would she say it would be better for her if she hadn't been born because she's seen what's happened to her sister and her father? Would I feel that it would be better if she hadn't been born? I think at root is a question, and whether we're talking about plastic surgery or genetics or end-of-life issues, a running issue is how are we confronting our mortality or not? Because part of mortality is not only that we're going to die, but that we are imperfect. Now, some imperfections like Tay-Sachs and these kinds of diseases that the children, you know, like they're born only with a brainstem. You know, obviously, I don't see any reason why those pregnancies need to continue. And I am a person who has always been part of the pro-life group in America, right? So it's not that I want to stop those kinds of reproductive rights and choices, but I'm just thinking, how are we making these choices? And is it based on certain perceptions of what is better? And as a gay person, I do get a little nervous because I know that there are people out there who do not think they want a gay child. And you know, if that were ever possible, and I don't think that being gay is only genetic, but there are some genetic markers, perhaps, possibly, you know. Yeah, go ahead.
There's a lot of thoughts going on. I don't know how to articulate them very well, but one piece was that just recently there was a study about preventative healthcare and the cost of preventative healthcare. We've been really emphasizing that. But now they're finding out that preventative healthcare is keeping us all alive so much longer that they're spending $100,000 a person more because now we're all making it to much older age and we have, you know, really severe cardiac problems and cancers that are much more expensive than us dropping dead at, you know, 72.
Yeah.
You know. And so that's interesting to me, as well as selecting for these things, you know, are the flavor of the month.
And that's why
your sermon of, you know, let your light shine. What is that light? And some people's light is Harvard doctors, and some people's lights are really good plumbers and really good social workers and really good, you know, every spectral
yeah.
realm, and how, who are we to select
right.
the flavor of the month and end up with a culture that doesn't work anymore because we've
uh-huh.
too many of the CEO kinds.
I don't yeah. I am half Norwegian, but I don't know how many Norwegians we can handle in this society. but here's what I wrestle with. My mind, as you can tell, is clearly not made up. I don't have a conclusion that I want you all to draw because I'm so much wrestling with this. But on one hand, I think of this. I think of the parents of Down's kids who have said to me and to genetic counselors, if genetic testing had been available when I was pregnant, I wouldn't have had this child, and I'm so glad it wasn't because I'm so glad I had this child.
Yeah.
So that's one side of it, okay? Then there's the other side of it is I have a child who doesn't show any signs as of yet of any kinds of learning disabilities. He may, but I didn't have to confront that. And is it, again, as an individual, do I have a right to impose that responsibility on other people who may not feel up to it? Especially when we have not a very just socioeconomic system and social support system for them. So can I say, well, it's not my issue, but you have to have that child. And okay, we all beef up the social economic system for you a little bit, but you know, that is a very personal decision. But sometimes you don't know what you're up to and you can't foresee what it means until you're in it.
Well,
so
it makes me think too of the woods, you know, the talk we all had on the boat coming up here about how we tampered with the woods and not letting the burn cycle happen.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody else had heard a talk about the wolves and how they had taken the wolves out of Yellowstone and what that has done.
Yeah.
All the way down to the mice. You have no idea. And as smart as we think we all are, we can anticipate what all the problems are going to be.
Well, there are also the issues of we need recessive genes. We actually need these genetic anomalies. You know, we need the genetic diversity and ecosystems in ourselves. First you and then Chris. Go ahead.
Well, I have a cousin in Norway, and his wife and he both professors, and they have three children. One is a Down's. And I know that this isn't true all over, but I do know that people who continue their education tend to have children a little later, you know. Okay, and they did make the decision to keep the Downs, and they did know, you know, that he would be a Downs. Okay, the point I'm making is they also said, we have a very good community, the university.
That will support us.
There tend to be children that have different issues because, okay, but right again, you're saying exactly what you said before, that it's socioeconomic because they have a support system.
And it's socioeconomic, but it's also a culture of welcome.
Yes.
You know, how do we look at those kids and those people? And, you know, and the special ed programs that are sometimes so isolating and people feel so stigmatized by that, you know, versus the gifted and talented programs.
Well,
is that ever
true?
Yeah.
Everybody tells about they're gifted and talented. But
I have an honor roll student and all those bumper stickers, right?
Yeah.
My kids are special ed.
So it's also a highly valued.
Yeah.
Just
we
like
smart
you said.
Yeah. Chris, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say that the way in which we spend, those of us who have the capacity, spend so much on healthcare we want, while thousands of kids die of simple healthcare, just makes a mockery of our value of equality.
Mm-hmm.
We don't value equality at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we value getting what we want, and we're willing to go to unbelievable, you know, as I learn more about what's available, we just keep going farther and farther and paying more and more to get what we want while people die.
Are children a gift or are they by our design?
Mm-hmm. I just retired from teaching for 22 years and I still see children thrown away by parents.
Oh, yeah.
And it breaks your heart because we, you know, like you said, there's a lot of children in the whole world that don't get basic health care.
Just
and
the very basic.
Just, you know, anything. And even clean water to drink.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then we have in our society where we have clean water and all this, people who don't value the children that they had so easily.
Yeah.
And they're gone. And it just breaks your heart.
I work as a pediatric genetic counselor, so I work with families who have children, with many with developmental disabilities, and many are coming for a diagnostic evaluation and for counseling for themselves and their family. And often they've had some testing or screening during pregnancy, and I think there's such a strong cultural pervasive sense that we do have control, that we can test for everything, that our child, that we should expect to have children who are healthy. And, you know, I find I do so much education to reassure families, because we've done such a good job of saying to moms, you know, don't drink during your pregnancy or do all the right things, that what happens when a child is born, as 3 to 5% of all children will be born with a birth defect or genetic condition, you know, our hospital is still kept very, very, very busy with hundreds of different, thousands of different diagnoses, is the grief and burden for those families of feeling so strongly feeling, you know, what have I done? What should I have done? How did this get missed?
How did this happen?
Who did, you know,
whose fault is it?
Why wasn't this picked up? Or what would have I done anyway? But this, we do have such a sense that we can control. And that we must have, you know, there must have been something that went wrong that we could have controlled.
Which is exactly
to control.
Which comes up so much at the end of life as well. We spent an incredible disproportionate amount of money in end of life care, and people who have a lot of affluent means. This is from my time as a chaplain in California. I encountered this. Great insurance, great private resources, are well-to-do and well-known in their professions and such, are shocked when the doctor says there's really nothing more. There's got to be something more. We talk about science, faith, and what do people believe in. And for some folks, it is medical technology is their God. They are sure it is going to deliver them from this thing called human finitude or mortality.
Sonia, did you? Well, we had a case in Connecticut year before last that was settled. It was the first one of its nature where a family had come in for their prenatal test, for their prenatal visit. They had declined the screening for Down syndrome. It was documented in the chart that they declined it. They were given written information about the test that they had declined. They had a child with Down syndrome. They sued, saying they didn't understand the full extent. They won, and they were giving $17 million.
Juries do that, though, and that's our fault. People in juries will do that.
But that's also the idea of autonomy gone amok, in a way, you know, meaning control. And it also is a way that and the idea of blame and self-blame, this has got to be somebody's fault, and we're gonna to the tune of 17.
Well, I think our culture, we do not remember our past. We don't, you know, we don't remember our grandparents sharing, you know, their miscarriages and their losses, or even our community. We just have this such a forward progression. We just assume things are going to get better and better, and that our lives are going to be better. That we just demand more, but it's also because we forget that sense of community and sense of, I mean, I think some of that is missing from our culture, that actually affects the decisions we make and how we expect that sense of perfection.
Just on a personal note on that, of that prenatal screening, I had a good friend before I became pregnant. I had a good friend who had the screening done for Down syndrome and had, you know, an elevated percentage of risk for having Down syndrome child. And just seeing her emotional struggle of, you know, trying to decide, am I going to have an amniocentesis? And, you know, what are the chances of miscarriage? And all of this made me decide not to have that test. But, I mean, just all the emotions involved in it.
And some women feel, if they're over 35, they do feel a lot of pressure to have the information in the test. Other places, they don't feel that way, and they're very much supported. But it is kind of like, some women have said, I feel like, well, I'm not having an abortion regardless, so it doesn't, why do I have the test? But, you know, other women are just feeling kind of scared and vulnerable and not sure if they should or shouldn't. They kind of want to do it naturally and want to know. Yes.
Thanks. Well, I find myself like I'm getting very emotional. this is really touching a nerve. And it seems to me like an enormous failure of our moral sense, wherever that comes from, whether it comes from religion or whatever. I hear the absurdities of, you're talking about the cosmetic surgery yesterday or the ridiculous extents people go to avoid the basic suffering of life.
Mm-hmm.
As being similar to what we make fun of when we talk about the decay and fall of the Roman Empire, the how far out of reality they soared before collapse. That there was no sense of proportion in what I have a right to because I have the means to acquire it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, if I have the means, mm-hmm. or if we have the technology
right.
to acquire it, therefore it is our right and our obligation.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, we're leaving behind billions of people
yeah.
who are dying in abject poverty
yeah.
from preventable diseases because
right.
we're so busy having
because,
this fantasy.
Right, right.
And to me, the response has to go deeper than policy. It has to go to the very core of our relationship to the cosmos, what we're about, what is the meaning of life? And if we can't accept death and loss as an inevitable part of a meaningful and inevitable part of any life,
mm-hmm.
whether it's meaningful or not, then we're just getting farther and farther away from our center.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Park. I really think we spend so much time at this more superficial level when the deeper issues are confronting imperfection, mortality, being creatures. I mean, I do think we can be co-creators. I do think that science has made our lives a whole lot better and that we should rejoice in that and that we shouldn't just reject what science has to offer because, well, my grandparents didn't have it. But on the other hand, it's gone to such an extreme of, if we can do it, then we should do it.
And quantity over quality.
And quantity over quality. And
mm-hmm.
the entitlement thing that is so disconnected from what other millions of people are living with in those conditions. So I think that we are wrestling with some signs of idolatry in terms of immortality, in terms of perfection, and in terms of my individual entitlement and right. And I'm speaking specifically of the U.S. context here. We haven't got time to talk about death yet, but I think 7:15 is a great time to talk about death tomorrow morning because I'm doing an eye opener. So I invite all of you to this room at 7:15 and let's talk about end of life care because the deepest questions, as Park so eloquently said, is what is a good life and how do we live well and how do we die well? And can we develop some sensibilities about that? Because the thing is, the more we come in tune with this disconnect and what we would want to put forward, the more that we share that with others, the more we can start to reframe some things. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to convert everybody, but we're going to get people to think about things more deeply than they had. If simply, I can afford it, I want it, I'm going to do it. I think having children is more than that. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Should we call it an eye closer?